Hello everyone, I'm your host, Nolan Brewer, and you're watching Artist Corner. Today I'm joined by a special guest, Akash Thakkar. Akash Thakkar is a video game composer, musician, sound designer, and audio director. He's worked on games such as Hyper Light Drifter, Hyper Light Breaker, Outer Wilds, Echoes of the Eye, Destiny, Rise of Iron, High on Life, and many more. Akash is also a prolific public speaker and has given TEDx talks on following your passions and the creative side to business freelancing. Without further ado, here's the episode. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Artist Corner. I'm your host, Nolan Brewer, and today I'm joined by a special guest, Akash Thakkar. Thanks so much for joining me, Akash.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
When you're given a visual of something that you need to design sound for, what is typically the first question that you ask yourself to lead the project in the right direction?
Yeah, so usually when I'm given a visual, it can be anything from concept art, which is just like this early imagination of what the game will look like, to 3D renderings of just a couple characters. So it really varies wildly. But as much as I can, I'll try to ask the director or the artist or whoever's in charge to sum up the tone in as few words as possible. And a great example of this is when I worked on Hyper Light Drifter, I asked the director, Alex Preston, like, okay, sum this up in as few words as possible, tone-wise. And he said, neon nightmares, which is a great way to summarize it. And that gives you an exact like kind of direction to go with. Like, okay, that's really cool. What's a neon nightmare sound like? And it gives you enough to go off of to start designing from there.
Hmm. Do they ever give you some examples of other art or movies or games that you can go off of?
Yeah, sometimes yes, sometimes no, but it depends on the project. But yeah, for things like Hyper Light, I was given lots of anime references, you know, so Gundam, Evangelion, stuff like that, of course, because the game was heavily inspired by that. And there are definitely projects where they don't give you anything and they're like, oh, we're not sure. You figure it out. That's your job. Like, okay, that's also totally fine. So both are totally valid. But I think there's sometimes a hesitation to give reference because people think like, oh, I'm gonna step on their toes or something. But I love getting reference. Like, that's always very handy because that kind of puts everyone on the same page.
And what is your research process like when they don't give you any examples?
Yeah. So when working on a project, when they give you nothing or as little as possible, then it's a lot of iteration at first. So I'll just basically there's concept art. I'd like to make concept sound. Mm-hmm. So I'll just make rough drafts. So it could be anything from a 1 minute ambience to like, here's some ideas that I had of like what combat should sound like. It's not to any visual. It's literally just a designed soundscape of what I think things should sound like. Or it could even be something like, oh, okay, you have no idea. I'm going to make some reference. I'm going to get some reference. So I'm going to throw these things at you. Like, how about Diablo? How about this? How about that? I'll throw random things at them and see what they think. And that can get us on the same page as well.
Do you ever use references from real life as well?
Oh, yeah. So like not for a broad tone of a project, but definitely for specific things. So for example, there will definitely be times where I need to kind of listen to how a sound comes into the scene. And a really good kind of real life example that we don't really pay attention to when we're walking out on the street is how far away can you hear a car coming up to you? Because you can see it way before you can hear it. And the tire sounds come in at a certain distance and it's way closer than we think it is. So those little references of like, okay, that, I'm going to go with that. Oh, okay, that fades in a really interesting way. But I won't tend to make my sounds as real world as possible. I tend to stray away from that. If you asked me to do something like The Last of Us, I'd be fired in 2 minutes because I'm just not a realism guy at all.
That's fair. Yeah, I think it's cool because you can have a great sound, whether or not it sounds realistic or if it's more based on fiction. I think it really, in my opinion, I think it really just depends on the direction of the project. Mm-hmm. And having a variety of places to get inspiration from really helps with leading it to the right direction. That's what my understanding of it is.
Yeah, for sure. And a lot of sounds, music, whatever it may be, always go along a spectrum of realism to stylization of sound. So like a totally realistic sound is pretty rare in a game. A totally stylistic sound that has no reference to the real world is also pretty rare. So you have some sort of in between where if you have an explosion and you want it to sound cool, it still has to feel like an explosion. It still has to have some realism to it. Still needs some sort of pop, some sort of boom to it. And then you can add other stylish layers on top. So it really kind of has a spectrum that goes from realistic to stylistic.
Yeah. How many revisions do you often have to make for sound effects before they can be used in the game?
It can be pretty wild. It can go from zero to literally dozens. I think the most I ever did, I can't remember the exact number, but it sometimes goes into the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s of just like, try it again. All right, let me try it again. Oh, the game changed. Let's do it again. So sometimes it may be that the sound was working just fine, and then something in the game changed to where, oh, now the sound is no longer working just fine because the animation timing changed or something switched. And now it needs another revision. But that's 100% a part of the process, especially with games where it's constantly changing. Whereas if you get a film, it is locked in and done, and that's kind of it.
Has that ever happened to you last minute where you had to make a revision really quickly?
Oh, all the time. That's every game. Every single
Oh,
game. There's always last minute revisions and changes because some design decision happens or there's some trickle-down effect, right? Like an animator's like, oh, this will be way cooler. Cool, let's put it in. And then eventually it gets to me where I'm like, oh shit, this needs to change.
and how would you say the time restraints compare when you're working on a smaller project compared to a bigger project?
The time restraints are pretty similar across, because for me at least, I make a very big point to get it hired as early as possible. I do notice that the really, really big projects tend to hire later on in the development cycle. But this isn't universal by any means. This is just my own experience. So I noticed with the indie games or like the higher end, like the higher budget indie games, they tend to hire me super early on and say, like, all right, we're going to be working together for the next 3 years. Whereas the more AAA end of things, like, all right, this game is coming out 6 months from now. Oh God, we need help. So I noticed that more. But again, that's not a universal thing.
Have there ever been any times where the time restraints they changed later on in the project? Maybe it got delayed and then you had to change a lot of the creative process for that because of it?
Yeah, so games always get delayed. I have a sixth sense for this where I know when a game is actually going to come out basically every time. So when a developer says, oh, this is coming out in October, I'm like, no, it's actually going to be June of 2024. And I'm always right. I'm always nail it. So this basically, it doesn't change my process ever. It honestly just gives me more time, which is very nice. But I don't think I've ever been on a project ever in my life that wasn't delayed, ever. And I think that's true of most people in games. Every single game gets delayed. It's just so common. And I think it's silly that we try to keep two release dates as long as we do.
Yeah, release dates are tricky. I mean,
Yeah.
on one hand, it gets people excited about a game, but on the
Right.
other hand, if it always gets delayed, there's always going to be some d disappointment from people when they hear it.
Exactly. And I guarantee everybody on the development team, when a release date is announced two ahead of time, they all know it's going to be delayed. Every single developer, from the newest person to the most senior, is like, oh no, we know that's a fake release date. Like it's just a totally known thing.
Yeah. So, how different do you think your sound design process compares when working on games compared to films?
Yeah, so I haven't worked on film in a bit, but the process is actually similar, if not the same. But the kind of thought behind each thing is a little different in that for games, obviously I need to think about repetition. So they're going to be swinging the sword a lot. I need to make it sound like it's fine to be repeated over and over. Whereas in a film, you can say, ah, this is the one time this car engine revs. I don't need to worry about it repeating. Let me just design it so perfectly, and I don't need to worry about, three different variations of it. I don't need to worry about it looping or anything like this. So games tend to have a little more thought behind that, but you can't necessarily go as hard as you can on every single little minutia like you can in a film where you can say, okay, I'm going to spend 3 hours on just this one engine sound, and I know once it's done, it's done. Whereas with games, you'll have to kind of iterate and think in other ways, thinking, okay, this will loop, this will transition to this. Okay, there needs to be a gear shift sound, and this gear shift sound needs to be able to happen at any time. So there's just a different thought process, but the actual creation of it is basically the same.
And you were actually a Foley artist on The Employer, is that right?
So it was a movie I did a while ago.
Would you say that recording Foley is a different process from other types of sound design?
Yeah, Foley's kind of, it's obviously sound design, you're recording stuff and kind of making it work, but it has a different thought process in that you're kind of performing more so than you're actually just designing. Obviously, you're designing, you're layering stuff on top of one another to make it work, but you're performing it in such a way to make it fit the scene as good as possible. Or in the case, if you're just recording Foley for the sake of it and it's not to a movie, then you want to kind of go about it in the sense of like, okay, I'm going to build a library. I'm going to make 3 dozen cloth swoosh sounds that will work perfectly just for this game. And then you'll kind of use them throughout the project later. So yeah, the thought process is a little bit different, but the use case of Foley is, like any sound design thing where you're going to make it work within whatever scene or focus that you're working with.
Have you ever used any of your recorded Foley in a piece of music?
Oh, sure. So, not is Foley, not so much, but I will use it in, I will use Foley in ambiences a lot. So I will take things like I will record, I did this for Hyperlight Drifter where the end boss has this kind of low drony ambience to it. And that's the sound of my blood going through my veins with a stethoscope microphone I made. So I use that and use that as a bed as the ambience of that final boss fight. So that's kind of the sort of stuff I'd like to do. And, I worked on a game called The Outer Wilds, the DLC for that, so Echoes of the Eye. And that's a horror themed kind of expansion to The Outer Wilds. And I basically recorded a lot of weird kind of or I took a lot of regular everyday sounds and stretched them out into really weird ways to make the ambience work better.
Sorry, can I think for a second?
Yeah, of course.
So, when you stretch out Foley, do you have to pay careful attention to how you're doing that? Because there's a lot of times where you stretch stuff out and it might sound a little weird at first. Are there any
Totally.
things that you do to make it sound cohesive with either the music or the audio in that part of the story?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. So if you just take something and stretch it out, it does sound weird pretty much all the time. So there's a lot of processing that goes on too. So it'll be things like reverb or things like pitch shifting or reversing, just basically throwing the kitchen sink at it to make it sound not like a stretched out footstep, basically. Just all sorts of weird stuff that you can do. You can even throw it into a wavetable synthesizer and turn it in to put it on your keyboard and then stretch it out even further in really weird ways. So all that sort of stuff to make it not sound like the original source.
And I also know that whenever you stretch it out to be longer, or not stretch it out, but if you change the pitch of a sound to be lower down the keyboard, then it sounds a bit different than when it's higher up. And I think you have to be more careful with how fast it is, because I think it changes the speed of it depending
That's
on where
right.
it is.
Depending on where it is on the keyboard, that's right. Yeah, and like you can definitely stretch things out so that they're kind of time independent, like the play rate is the same, but the pitch is different. But basically, when I do that sort of thing, I tend to want it to last as long as possible. So sometimes I'll just stretch it out. Like I'll use a tool called Paul Stretch and I'll be like, this sound is now 800 days long, and then just make it, put it on a key, and then that's that.
Wait, how do you get an 800 days long audio?
Oh, you gotta try it. It's actually in Audacity for free. It's a tool called Paul Stretch or Paul's Extreme Sound Stretcher. You can just Google it, and you can literally take any sound, doesn't matter, plop it in, and how long do you want it to be? And you can type in anything, even on the order of days, and it'll just do it. And it sounds really cool. It's really neat.
Yeah, that sounds incredible. I've
Yeah, it's
never,
totally free.
I didn't know you could do it for that long. That's awesome.
Yeah, it's great.
So, do you think it's important to be a musician as a sound designer?
Not necessarily, though. I think knowing music stuff has helped me a great deal. I don't think you necessarily need to know to how to like compose beautiful orchestral pieces to be a sound designer, but knowing some music is extremely helpful because there are musical sound design moments. So things like Mario, Sonic, those sorts of things, that's stylistic sound design. It's all musical. It's all using, major chords and all that sort of stuff. If you just stretch it out and slow it way down, you're like, oh, that's just like a C major chord. Oh, crazy. And knowing how to do that is a huge, huge, huge help.
Yeah, and I think there's also sound effects in games that it kind of has a motif in the sound effect, that kind
Yeah.
of stuff.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Like even again, if it's just your chords, like that's such a massive advantage.
Yeah, for sure. So, some of the earlier projects you worked on were Tesla the Weatherman
Yeah.
and also Map Monsters and Line of
Yeah.
Fire. Has your creative process changed since then? And what do you think you would do differently if you were hired to work on them now?
Oh man, that's a good question. So yeah, dramatically my process has changed because those projects I did like while I was in college, basically, or like right after. No, actually during. So I didn't know what I was doing. I had no idea how to do sound design. To some extent, I still have no idea what I'm doing, but my process has changed dramatically because back then I was terrible at kind of the core skill of sound design, which is layering. That is the kind of one of the more important skills, which is being able to stack a bunch of sounds on top of one another, stuff that you've recorded or synthesizers or from a library or a mix of all of the above, and making it sound like a cohesive whole that is a unique thing in the end. I didn't know how to do that back then. I had no clue. So I was going with sounds that were just one layer and very thin sounding to now like a 20 layer sound is like, oh, it's kind of small. Like it's really changed dramatically over time. So I would probably layer way harder if I went back in time.
Well, that honestly, I think I'm where you are at right now, and I think I'm really glad that I asked you that question because now I'm gonna definitely up my layering game for sure.
It's key, and I can't think of a single sound designer who is newer that doesn't like that layers well. Like it's the core thing. It's the marker I can tell if I listen to a demo reel of someone. I'm like, oh, they're not layering. They're new. Like it's just such an instant tell. But back then,
Wow.
I couldn't hear it. I couldn't hear the difference between a layered and not layered sound.
And when you layer a bunch of sounds together, do you have to focus more on the frequency spectrum?
Yeah, so you really need to make sure that all the sounds aren't clashing, So if you have a bunch of bassy sounds, it's just going to sound really boomy and just not full. So yeah, you need to make sure they're all balanced kind of against one another volume-wise. You want to make sure that, if you have a lot of bassier sounds, that they're not clashing with one another or too overpowering. But it's not the sort of thing where there's a formula. It's not the sort of thing where you go like, okay, there needs to be this much high, this much mid, this much low. It really depends on the sound.
And I think from what I've heard over time, I think if you train your ear a lot from listening to songs you like and looking or listening to what the frequency ranges are, I've heard that that helps a lot too.
It does. And having reference material that you're listening to constantly really helps. So, for example, one thing I recommend people do is have, let's say, a sound effect they really like. Let's say it's like a lightsaber sound, and they're making their equivalent. Have the lightsaber sound, the original one, in your project and listen to, like, hit space bar and listen to it and go back and forth between yours and theirs, yours and theirs, yours and theirs, every millisecond that you possibly can. Because what happens to us is we start to think like, oh, mine's pretty close, mine's pretty close, and we forget what we're kind of aiming for. And then we listen to the original lightsaber sound, like, oh my God, ours, mine's so much worse. So having reference is just unbelievably important to being able to hear all those different frequencies and how thick you want your sound or thin you want your sound to be.
Yeah, and not only is that important in sound design, I think it's also important just in music in
Yeah,
general.
totally. Yeah, because it's really easy to just make like a synth line that's just one synth, and you're like, that sounds fine. And then you realize, you see a project of like Virtual Riot or Skrillex or something, you're like, oh my God, there's 60 different things all layered on top of one another here. No wonder it sounds so good.
Don't know if you've ever experienced this, but there have been times too where I was in my DAW and I was making something that I thought sounded great. And then as soon as I listened to it outside of my DAW, I realized how much work it needed.
Yeah, I call it export syndrome. Like we all have that, and the way around it is to hit play and turn around and then listen to it inside your DAW. If you turn around, it changes everything because your eyes aren't focused on the DAW, so there's more space kind of placed on it, which is why when we export and we listen, We don't have a visual to go with. We're just listening, and that's why we can hear better.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, I think I have this. I don't know if this is a problem per se, because there's definitely composers in the past, for example, who, you know about impressionist music, right?
Oh,
Where
yeah, totally.
they would compose to a painting.
Yeah.
There's a lot of times where I do that, but I look at album art that I like
Oh,
from
yeah,
artists.
perfect.
And in some way, I think that helps, but I think sometimes I need to maybe, I guess, get rid of all the visual sensory details and just use my ears completely. And that I think that was great advice. So,
Yeah, just turn around. Makes a big difference.
and it's so simple too, but we don't really think about that stuff
We don't think
sometimes.
about it. Yeah, totally. Yeah, everyone has export syndrome. It's normal.
Would you mind telling the story of how you got hired for Hyperlight Drifter?
Oh yeah, totally. So this was 2013? 2013 or 2014, one of those years. And I had just recently graduated in 2012 and just moved to Seattle, where I am now, after, leaving college. And the game, like the project of Hyperlight Drifter came up on Kickstarter, and everyone was talking about it. I was like, holy shit, this looks so cool. And then I realized that Rich Vreeland, who I think you've interviewed, is on the was on the was on the project as the composer. And Rich and I went to school together. He was 2 years ahead of me, but we knew each other. And I literally just emailed him, was like, hey, so you're looking for a sound designer? Fully expecting a no, like fully expecting him to be like, no, we're get no, we're fine. But he's like, actually, yes, you should talk to Alex Preston, the director. So I email him. He's like, yeah, we're actually looking for a sound designer. So how about you do an audio test? Like, basically, I'm going to give you some like, gameplay videos, and you are basically going to make some sound, and we'll see if it's a good fit. So he made me design a sword sound and then a sound for a dash for Hyperlight. And so basically, I had 1 week because they're going to be showing off the game at a conference that week as well. So basically, I started out and I made three iterations on the sword sound and three, I think maybe three or four iterations on the dash sound. And I didn't know this until after, but he told me later on in the project, and I think after it finished, he's like, you know, the first few sounds you made, I didn't really like, and I thought we were just kind of gonna fire you. But it turns out, like the next iterations I made, because Alex is a really good director, he gave me good direction on what he was looking for, and those iterations are what made me like, oh, okay, yeah, this is cool. We can work together on this.
And was there anything that they gave you to go off of for the game, or was it one of those projects?
Initially for that audio test, I didn't really have much. I had gameplay, like I could see the early version of the game, so you could play it just a little bit. It was just one room, so I had that. And then there were the references of anime. So it's like, okay, like Evangelion's a huge reference. It's like all these sorts of lasery sort of anime sorts of sounds. That is definitely one thing. But that wasn't initial. Those references came on when I was more involved with the project. So, and like stuff would come up all the times from things like Silent Hill, I think, or all sorts of Japanese games, essentially, because they have very unique sound design. I can't remember all the specifics that we talked about. But there are quite a few of anime slash anime game. Metal Gear Solid was a really big one that came up a lot because that is amazing sound design. So those sorts of games came up a lot as reference.
So I'm aware that plugins and VSTs are used a lot for sound design, but I actually don't know if hardware is used often. Would you say that hardware was used a lot for Hyperlight Drifter?
So hardware's some people love it, some people absolutely love it. I tend not to be a hardware person. The only hardware that I used was a thing called a wire recorder, where basically it's a 1950s recording device that came out before tape. So when you hear the term from like an FBI movie, like, oh, he's wearing a wire, this is what they're talking about. This is the old school term. But it's because this recorded directly onto metal filament that looks just like a fishing wire. It looks identical. So it's this thin metal wire that it records onto. And it works just like tape, where it's two reels spinning and it's just sending a wire through this little recording, this little hole, and it just magnetizes it, just like tape, just like how tape records. But it is incredibly finicky in that it snaps and breaks constantly all the time. And to fix it, you literally have to tie metal in a knot to itself. It's incredibly difficult to do. Yeah, it snaps and breaks all the time. Rewinding it is the scariest thing in the world because it's gonna snap and break. It's probably gonna burn my house down one day because when you turn it on for more than 10 minutes, it's like vrr, and makes like this crazy humming sound.
Oh no.
And so, but that's what I use to record a lot of the source material for Hyperlight to give it kind of a more unique sound.
Do you think learning hardware is a valuable skill to have as a sound designer?
Not really, because all the principles that hardware has is the same nowadays in software. So, for example, most hardware that sound designers use are synthesizers. Literally everything that is on a hardware synthesizer is in a software synthesizer: oscillators, filters, all that sort of stuff, LFOs, envelopes. Those are all in hardware and software. So, actually, how I learned, and I'm glad I learned this way, was software first. So in college, we did software and we just designed synthesizers from scratch. Like, okay, here's a sine wave, just work with that. Here's one filter and a sine wave, now work with that. And that was fine. That was totally great. Because now, if I do look at hardware, I don't master it instantly, but I can tell, like, oh, here's the oscillator, here's the sound source, this is a filter, this is the envelope, this is the LFO, here's the effect. Oh, okay, I get it. And then you can just go. So as long as you know the principles, you can do hardware or software, it doesn't matter.
Well, that's really good information. I think that sometimes I feel like there's a lot of, what's the word? Mystification, maybe, about
Yeah.
hardware and whether or not you should use hardware or synths. But after
Yeah.
talking to a lot of different people, I think a lot of it just comes down to preference.
Totally.
And
And budget, because some
oh,
people will spend,
yeah.
$20,000 on a bunch of synths just because they love it. Like, they fully acknowledge, oh yeah, I could do this in software tomorrow, easy, but I just like having the knobs. And there is something nice about having knobs.
Yeah, I mean, you could, there's some things you can do in a plugin for like $100 that you'd have to
Exactly.
do for $2,000 in a hardware sense.
Exactly. Yes. And I don't like having stuff. I don't like owning things. So having hardware is out of the question for me.
Yeah. Although work-life balance is a common discussion nowadays, I think it's kind of important to talk about still because so
Yeah.
many people struggle with it, including myself.
Oh, yeah. It's
And
tough.
I was wondering, have you ever struggled with that balance? And if so, what are some examples of things you did to manage your work with life?
Yeah, it's tough. It's very, very tough. And I've definitely struggled. I think everyone has.
Yeah.
Because especially early in your career, it's easy to want to do everything because you feel like you have to. Otherwise, you'll fall behind or whatever your brain is telling you. But what I've noticed is that, well, let me actually give you a little example. So here's an example from a guy named Derek Sivers, who started a company called CD Baby and then sold it for 30 million and then gave it all away to charity. Great guy, love him. But he has this great analogy where he was going on this bike ride every single day, right? He had this bike route that he would always love to do. It was a couple miles. And when he would push super, super, super hard, just like absolute all-out effort as best he could to do this bike route, it would take him about 40 minutes. Then one day he decided, you know what? I'm gonna just chill. I'm just gonna enjoy this route. I'm gonna like enjoy the sunshine. I'm going to notice what's around me instead of just going as hard as I can. It took him like 46 minutes. So the difference was only a 6 minute slower. It's like slower. It wasn't substantial. And that is a really good way to think about this work-life balance thing, is that we think we're getting somewhere faster. We're not. Because here's the thing, at the end of that 40-minute one, the fast, hard one, he was tired. At the end of the 46-minute one, he was happy and recharged. There's a big difference on the other side. And I think the equation comes in where, how do you feel after? Because we tend to think of like, oh, I put in this effort, therefore I will get this reward. But if you put in this effort and then feel like death, you can't, the reward doesn't really matter. Or if it does come, you're not going to be able to capitalize on it that well. There are a lot of kind of variables in sense there. That doesn't mean don't do anything, but there's a fine line there where you need to find that equivalent of like, how much can I ease up while making this as sustainable as possible? And everyone's different. It's like some people I know will be able to work 12-hour days and are totally fine. They have no issue with it. They have no interest in other things other than that thing. That's fine. And some people will be like, I'm going to put in 3 hours a day and that's it. Like, I don't care. So that you find kind of your equivalent and where you can leverage your time as best as possible.
I'm glad you said that You don't mean not to do anything, because there are definitely times in the past where I've heard that kind of advice, and I thought that meant, oh, that means I can make all the mistakes that I want to make. But that's obviously not true. That doesn't mean to only make mistakes and not care about it. I think it just means to maybe slow down a little bit and be okay with not, just be okay with being in the present, I guess.
Like, be okay with dropping the ball, I will say. Like, there are strategic ways to screw up. And I think once you learn how to strategically screw up in such a way where it won't affect anything and no one will be mad at you, that's what a pro does. An amateur thinks they need to do everything full bore, and it destroys them. I've seen many careers destroyed this way. I've seen people quit because of that exact mindset. Whereas a pro will be like, this matters, this doesn't. I'm gonna half-ass this thing. I'm gonna full-ass this thing. This is because this is what matters. I get a huge result out of this. I get no result out of this. That's how a pro thinks, and that's kind of the smarter way to go about it.
Do you have any kind of philosophies about self-reflection? And do you think that reflecting over things in your past has helped you get to where you are now?
Sure, yeah, absolutely. Like, I don't have any core philosophies of like do XYZ or anything like that,
That's
but
fine.
definitely reflecting is good, of realizing, where are you getting the best results from, or like what's actually making you happy, and what are things that, the 14-year-old you told you that you need to be doing that it turns out that 20-year-old you realizes was a really stupid idea. Right. Like, there will be things that you told yourself to be at 14 that you're still living out later in life, that you realize later that you're like, oh, that was, why am I listening to a 14-year-old? That doesn't know anything. So having that ability to reflect is really, really important.
Yeah, I think I relate to that actually, because there are times where I think we all have this inner voice of ours sometimes that beats ourselves up. And I think if you listen to it, a lot of the time you'll realize that that voice is actually just a younger version of yourself. And it's so funny how we tend to listen to that voice a lot, when the voice that is there is us at a time that we maybe didn't understand as much as we do now.
Yeah, your priorities, your needs, your desires should all change. And I think we live in a society where changing your mind is frowned upon, but I think it should be celebrated.
How do you, sorry, can I think for a second?
Yeah, of course.
How do you know when, so for example, if you do change your mind about something, how do you know when you're not letting yourself do something because you're trying to conform to social norms? Or I guess I need to think for a second, sorry.
Yeah, take your time. No rush.
How do you know when it's your internal bias stopping you compared to external forces?
That's a really good question. So, like we were talking about, a lot of self-awareness is needed there. But one thing that you can kind of think about, so if you're changing your mind, you're pivoting, you're quitting something, whatever it may be, the thing you need to ask yourself is, if I stop this thing, whatever it is, or if I change this thing or pivot, whatever it may be, in 10 years, will I care that I stopped this thing? So, for example, let's say you are practicing piano all the time and you start hating it. If you're like, okay, in 10 years, will I be sad that I stopped playing the piano? For some people, the answer will be like, oh yeah, I would have really wished that I kept going with this so I'd have the skill. And some people be like, I do not care. Like, this does not appeal to me at all. Really depends. But that is kind of the way to kind of think about it. And trusting that gut feeling is really important there. Because if you will be bummed out by it, then keep doing that thing. But one thing I will say is that there is this concept, but by an author named Seth Godin, who's like a business entrepreneur, marketing teacher. He's amazing. And he has this concept called the dip.
Oh, I've
And the
heard of
dip, oh, you've heard of that. Okay, amazing.
that.
Yeah. So the dip is this place that we all get to over and over and over and over in our lives, our careers, our relationships, everything, where everything sucks. We're making no progress. It feels like we're grinding. It feels like everyone else is surpassing us. It feels like death. It's awful. And you will go through multiple dips throughout your life. And you never ever want to quit something in the middle of a dip, ever. You either quit when you just basically decide before you even start that you're not going to do it, or you quit at the high point. That's it. You do not quit in a dip because your emotional state in a dip is like, well, this sucks. I hate it. This is worthless. I'm never going to get good at this, blah, blah, blah. And then you'll likely be like, oh, I wish I didn't quit. So that's the one caveat I'll give there is if you quit in a dip, you're going to regret it. That is the main thing I'll give.
I remember I listened to an audiobook of a book called The Dip, and
Yeah,
that's how I
that's
heard
it.
about
Yeah,
it.
that's the one. That's the one.
Do you have any? So you've done a TEDx talk. Actually, you've done two TEDx talks
Yes, I've done
about
two. Yeah.
following your passions and the business side to creative freelancing. And I was wondering, do you have any advice for anyone who's a bit more introverted but wants to get into public speaking?
Oh yeah, sure. Absolutely. Yeah. So I'm super introverted. I'm as introverted as you can possibly go. And the thing I'll say is that introverts tend to very much excel at public speaking, because and you'll see like YouTubers tend to be introverts, public speakers tend to be introverts, rock stars tend to be introverts.
I'm an
All these
introvert.
people, yeah, there you go. Like a lot of these people, and a lot of people in the game field tend to be introverts. It's very common. But a lot of these creative types tend to be that. And the thing I'll say for those who are like, oh, I'd really like to public speak, is one, start as tiny as humanly possible. So one thing I did was while I was in college, I just did little talks here and there throughout my school years. That was a really great start because it was a very safe environment to do it in. And the other thing I will say is try if you're like, oh, but I don't know what to talk about. If there's something in your field or your industry or anything like that makes you mad, that's the thing to talk about. So an example is that when I graduated in 2012 and I went to my first GDC, the Game Developers Conference in San Francisco, which is this big game conference that tons of developers go to, it's tons of talks. I got really mad at all the really bad advice that was being given out to game audio people, like such terrible advice of like, oh, you have to have an agent. There's no other way to succeed. I was like, in 2012, like, who are these like 90-year-old dinosaurs saying this? I got really mad. And that's what got me more into public speaking too. I was like, oh, the reason that these people have the microphone and are saying this stuff is because I'm not stepping up to take the microphone from them to give actually good advice. It's my fault that they're there. So that's kind of what got me into it too. So if there's some contrarian thing or something that you're like, man, people have this wrong, it's a really good kind of impetus to get you speaking.
Have you ever thought about getting into a public debate?
Debate. I don't think I've ever done a debate, but if it comes up, I don't know when that would come up in game audio, but if it does, happily.
I'd be really interested to hear that. Maybe if there's someone that you disagree with on audio stuff, you'd talk about that.
If it's business stuff, I'd be happy to. If it's audio stuff, I'll be like, I don't care.
Was your process like for preparing for the TED Talks?
Yeah, so the TED Talks are pretty intense because what they did was you obviously have your topic and your general outline, like a general idea for your talk. And then for about 6 months, I think, I can't remember how many months it was, but every week basically, or every 2 weeks, you would go in and talk to the board of TED. And then basically you would give your speech over and over and over and over. And there was like a general speech coach, a body language coach, and like a voice coach. And they would all give you different feedback every single time. And they would just watch you stone-faced. You have to just go through. They wouldn't react. They wouldn't say anything. They wouldn't clap. They wouldn't laugh. They wouldn't smile. Nothing. Just gave you absolutely nothing. And you just had to do that over and over and over and over again until you just had it absolutely down. So that was the process for that. But what I do kind of nowadays when it comes to preparing for a talk, and this is the advice I give to people who are newer to public speaking, is don't necessarily try to memorize your talk completely. You can do that. Some people really like it, but one thing I'd recommend you do is Once you have a general idea of it, you have it kind of down to some extent, start from random points in your talk. So for example, maybe you have 20 slides for your talk. Start at slide 17. Start in the middle of a sentence. Start basically just jump around in random points and then go all the way through the end. Start slide 3, sentence 8, word 6, then start there and go to the rest. Because that will kind of get your brain it to a point where even if you stumble, which you will, and you will black out and forget, you'll have all these different points to latch onto in your head to kind of get you through to the end.
And when you were giving your TED Talks, did you get nervous at all during it? And how did you manage that when you were on stage?
Yeah, so for the first TEDx talk, my hands were shaking the whole time. You can't tell in the video, which is good. But yeah, they're shaking. And I think the second time too. I think my hands shake for every single talk I give, actually. So that's very, very common. The thing to do isn't necessarily to manage it. It's just to make it, just feel it and let it kind of go through you. Because if you try to resist it, it gets worse. It gets way, way, way worse. So the thing is, if you're well practiced, you just kind of go through it and it's not an issue. And you just let yourself actually feel it. And there's an author who I really like named Simon Sinek, who talks a lot about, public speaking. He's an amazing speaker. But he talks about if you are feeling nervous, to kind of reframe that language as excitement, like, oh, I'm excited, because nervous and excited are identical. Like physiologically, they're the same. There's no heart rate increase, sweat increase, brain speeds up, all it's the same. So if you start to reframe and change the language in your brain, it changes how you feel.
It's funny you say that. That's exactly how I view it because I don't know if you've listened to Nardwar at all. I'm sure you have, but that's he's given a TED talk actually about it's actually about nervousness. And I mean, I think you can't really, like you said, you can't really manage it, but you can if you let yourself feel it in a weird way that almost even just acknowledging that you're nervous will in a weird way just make it better, you know?
Yeah, and having curiosity about the emotions you're feeling that you want to kind of feel helps a lot. So if you feel anxiety, thinking like, okay, but where do I feel it in my body? How is it radiating? Is it all over my body or is it just in one spot? Asking yourself questions about it is like a massage where it like takes that thing and lets it just kind of release.
Yeah, it's really interesting how our brains work like that. When you've because there's been studies on this, I think, where I mean, have you heard about the don't think about a purple elephant thing?
Yeah, of course,
It's
yeah.
kind of like that, you know? If you tell yourself not to be nervous,
You're gonna be nervous.
you're gonna be even more nervous from telling yourself that, probably.
100%, absolutely.
Is there anyone or anything in your life that inspires you outside of music or games?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot. I'd say 99.9% of my inspirations are non-audio game related. But a big thing that keeps me kind of sane, grounded, and curious is jujitsu. That's a big thing. So I really like martial arts. I always have since I was a wee babe. But having basically these sorts of hobbies that I just really enjoy, they tend to put me into this meditative state that gives me good ideas later. An example is kind of like the shower thoughts that you get. So, when you go in the shower, you get all these thoughts. Similar to that. That's basically what these sorts of things do. So I tend to find, authors that are more business focused really inspiring. I tend to find people who are not in games in any way, shape, or form really, really inspiring. I tend to find hobbies that have nothing to do with anything that I'm doing. So it could be jujitsu, it could be like Pilates, like we were talking about before we started recording. It could be literally anything. Like, oh, like recently I got into electronics. So I was like, how do resistors work? I don't know. And
I
that
don't
can
even
be
know what that
really
is.
like it's just such an interesting thing to like learn from third party sources that have nothing to do with the thing. And that tends to inspire me more than the actual core.
Are there any YouTube channels or interviewers that you watch
Yeah.
besides someone like Charisma on Command that
Oh,
would
yeah. Oh, okay.
inspire how you do your podcast or just how you talk in general?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I'm not some genius at any of this, but people, I mean, I do like Charisma on Command. They're great. But I do really like Chris Doe from a podcast slash group called The Future with no E, so FUTUR. And he has this kind of, I don't know how you'd call it, but he's a genius graphic designer who's wildly successful, but he has this kind of secondary arm to his business, which is he teaches graphic designers specifically how to run a business. And that I love. I love the way he teaches. I love the way he talks about money. There are so few creative people who aren't scared to talk about money, and he's one of the few. And he got me more interested, and I've always been interested in negotiation, but he got me even more interested in it. And just hearing how he asks questions and how he thinks about conversation has been like a game changer for me.
Are there any exercises that you could give to someone who maybe wants to improve at their social skills?
Oh my God, there's so many. One thing I will tell everyone who's introverted to do is to practice the way you introduce yourself to people, as weird as that sounds, and practice your answers to really common questions. So, an example is when you introduce yourself, you'll say things like what your name is, you'll say where you're from, you'll say what you're up to, what games you're playing, stuff like that, you know? And most people will be like, hello, I'm a lawyer. End of conversation. You've killed the conversation because what everyone else is going to say is like, have you lawed anything good lately? They have nothing, they don't even know what to say to you. And you've destroyed the conversation. And so a different way to go, and this is actually an example from a friend of mine who I love so much. He's an estate lawyer. So he'll say things like, oh, I'm an estate lawyer. So I do sorts of cases where like a son will run over his sister to get the house. Like, and then I'm like, oh my God, tell me everything. Like I'm so interested with this extra detail that he added. So practicing little extra bits of detail to what you say to people to commonly answered questions, hugely important to keep a conversation going. Another example is someone will ask like, oh, where are you from? And for me, I'm from a tiny town called Fredericton, New Brunswick, in Eastern Canada that has absolutely nobody living in it. And I'm probably the only person to ever leave. And I will say basically, like, oh, I'm from a tiny town called Fredericton, New Brunswick, in Eastern Canada. And we are the meth capital, the illiteracy capital, the cigarette smoking capital, the weed capital, and yeah, of the entire country. And so the people are like, that's hilarious. And that's like, that's a conversation starter. So I'll give them little bits of extra detail. Most people don't do that, but if you can, you are gonna kill.
Yeah, so from my understanding, it's important to kind of look for all the common questions
Yeah.
and then I think adding specific details is really important. And like you said, it starts a conversation because if you just say one thing without adding that detail, they're gonna be like, I mean, that's kind of cool, but I don't really know where to go with that.
Exactly. There's nothing for them to hook on to. But if you say, like, for example, a lot of the time, and this happened to me all the time, when people say, oh, what games are you playing? If I didn't think about it before the conversation, I wouldn't know. Or like, what's your favorite game? Like stuff like that. I'd be like,
It's
I
funny
have
how that
no idea.
works.
It's funny, right? Like you're doing this thing, but you have no, you just it, your brain goes completely blank.
It's like
But if you say
sometimes
so, oh, go
someone
ahead.
asks you what you did that day and you just forget.
You just forget. Exactly. So I literally practice these things, and I recommend other introverts do too.
Do you practice it in front of a mirror at all?
No, I don't do it in front of a mirror. I just kind of mouth it to myself. Sometimes like when I first started doing this, I would literally write my introduction down and like workshop it. It sounds like a serial killer, but I literally did that. No one could tell. Everyone was like, oh, that's hilarious. And then a conversation would just go from there.
Yeah, I mean, actually, I think it's cool to just write stuff down too, because I don't know if you like Tim Ferriss. I mean, I'm sure
Oh, I love
you
him.
probably
Yeah.
do, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
But I learned about some journaling techniques from Tim Ferriss, and basically he an exercise he likes to do, I think, is where he'll just free journal. Free journaling is really cool. And you free journal whatever you're thinking about. And then when you're done free journaling, it could be about pizza or something.
Right.
And then you go back and you kind of re-edit everything you wrote to leave out stuff. And I think that in a way it shapes the way you think, which is so weird because you're writing it down. You're not using your full brain capacity. You're writing it down, you
Totally.
know?
Totally. It
It's so cool how that works to me.
is really interesting, but one thing I've noticed, just like what you said, is like the clearer a writer you are, the clearer a thinker you are, and the clearer a thinker you are, the clearer a speaker you are. So if you can get that order down, your thinking does change and improve.
Yeah, writing is so powerful.
Totally.
Are there any quotes you live by, whether well known or obscure, that have shaped who you are today as a creative person?
Ooh, that's a good question. Let me think on that for just a moment.
No rush.
You know, I have a quotes journal that I'm going to bring up
Yeah,
right now, if that's okay.
of course.
Because
I love that.
I have many, many, many. But let me find. Here we go. Da, 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 da.
Also, how are you doing so far?
Oh, I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm great too. I'm glad you're great.
Perfect. All right,
And
fantastic. You're asking some good questions.
you're giving great answers.
Oh, great. Thanks. I appreciate that. What's that? Here we go. All right. One second. Oh yeah. Here's a really good one. From a book called, I think it's called Creativity, The Magic Synthesis. I think that's the title. But
Oh,
it's
that sounds like
by
my thing already.
Yeah, it's really cool. Yeah, Rich recommended to me a while ago. It's really, really good. But he had the author is Silvano Ariety, so he's an Italian guy. But he has this quote where it's a creative project. Creative products are always shiny and new. The creative process is ancient and unchanging. So it's easy to think like, oh, this new synthesizer came out, this new thing came out, but that's not going to change anything.
Yeah.
You know, it's the creative process is the thing that you need to work on. That's the tool that you need to sharpen. So
Yeah.
that's a good one that I really
Yeah,
enjoy.
I totally agree because there have been times in the past where I've bought in a plugin, for example, and
Yeah.
I thought it had to have all the answers for making better music, but over the years I've learned that's nowhere near what it actually is like.
It never helps. It never fixes the thing. And like, as soon as you start poking at that plugin or whatever that new thing is, you instantly get a little disappointed because you're like, well, this isn't as cool as I thought it would be.
And you spent $100 on it or more.
Right. Right. Another one that I like that just came to me is Seth Godin, that guy who wrote The Dip. He says, you can either fit in or stand out, but not both. And that's a really important thing because I think a lot of people will try and do both. They'll be like, ah, I'm going to, you know, run my own business, but I'm going to do it in such a way where I kind of blend in with everyone else. Why isn't anyone hiring me? You know, you can't have it all. You can't have both at the same time.
Yeah. Speaking of blending in, by the way, do you think that getting advice from people and following other people's advice, do you think that in a way that makes you more likely to blend in instead of standing out on your own?
That's a great question. I don't think so because every single thing that we listen to, whether it be someone else's advice or a speech or pe even pieces of music, we can only listen to things through our own background. So our own background, our own upbringing always puts a lens on everything. And that lens, it's like it will immediately make that thing unique because something that is said to you, or maybe something that's said to both of us, we'll both hear it completely differently because of our respective backgrounds. So just that alone makes it a unique piece of advice to every single person who's listening to it.
Yeah, that reminds me actually of something Donald Glover said. And he said, "No one can outdo you at being you."
Yeah, 100%.
And I think that's a great quote, and it kind of, I don't know, it just puts into perspective on things.
Yeah, totally. And the kind of tricky part happens when we try to be someone else, then we just become a second-rate version. You know, there are 10 million composers I could hire today that sound exactly like Hans Zimmer, exactly like him. But I guarantee it's really hard for them to find work because why wouldn't people just go to Hans Zimmer?
Yeah. Actually, this kind of relates because I don't know how to say his name and I feel really bad about it, but one of the Final Fantasy composers that you actually got to play with,
Yeah, Nobuo
Nobuo.
Uematsu.
Yeah,
Yeah.
Nobuo. And he recently tweeted out something like that. He was talking about how, or not, he didn't tweet it out. I think it was this account that tweeted something
Oh.
he said, you know? But he said something like, movie like music in games. He was talking about movie like music in games and how he's tired of hearing that and thinks that game composers can't grow if they continue to keep trying to do that.
Yeah, I see what he means, and I do agree because I mean, Final Fantasy is a great example of a lot of music in Final Fantasy, not all of it, but a lot of it, if you put it into a movie, would be like, oh, that's a weird choice. But you put it into a game and you're like, this fits so freaking well. It's so fitting and perfect. But yeah, like I can see why, like getting inspiration from film, that's fantastic. But if we are just trying to make it exactly like a film, that does seem to kind of limit it a little bit.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, I feel like in indie games, there's actually so much more room to, I guess, try new things because in indie games, a lot of the time you have these smaller teams of people that don't have as many restraints that people have in bigger studios. And I think it's interesting to think about, you know?
Yeah, there's like the restraints are, you know, the way I think about it is that the restraints at every kind of level or tier or however you want to think about it, they're just different. You know, for a AAA studio, let's say it's just some giant game company, their restraint isn't necessarily money. They have lots of resources, they have lots of people, but they have their restraints are things like, okay, if we change one thing, 3,000 people now need to work on this new thing. That's a huge restraint. Whereas on a tiny game, you change one thing, people are like, oh, okay, cool. And then they tweak it and it works fine and you're good. But they might not have all the resources. They don't have the money. They can't make something, you know, as visually fidelity amazing. So yeah, the restraints are different and some cater to creativity better and some detract from it.
Yeah, there's two sides of the coin in that case.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I think that's gonna wrap it up for
Oh,
today's interview,
awesome.
if unless there's anything else you want to talk about in particular.
I think the only thing I'll say is that if anyone wants to reach out and ask questions, feel free because I'm pretty public and open about that stuff.
Yeah, actually, Akash has a really great podcast that you can check
Oh, thank
out.
you.
It's on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and I think everywhere, right?
Everywhere. Yeah, everywhere that
It's
podcasts are done.
Yeah, it's called The Sound Business with Akash the Car. And
Thank you.
yeah, if you guys enjoyed this episode, please let me know your feedback. And yeah, I think that's about it.
Beautiful.
I upload every Friday, and I am releasing an album soon, so stay tuned for that. And yeah, see you next Friday, everyone. Love
Awesome.
you
Thank you so
guys.
much.
Love you, Akash. Thanks for joining.
Thank you.
Hello, everyone. First of all, I'd just like to say thanks for listening to today's episode. I had a lot of fun talking to Akash about sound design, his creative process, public speaking, and just a lot of fun and interesting stuff. So I hope you can learn from it in some way too. And yeah, you can check out episodes of the show every Friday on YouTube, Spotify, and Apple Podcast. There's also a Patreon you can check out with benefits like early access to episodes for 2 days early. And yeah, that's about it. I'll see you guys next Friday. Thanks for listening.